This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present Age of Myth by Michael J. Sullivan. Narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds.
Welcome to the Legends of the First Empire, my latest fantasy series. If you haven't read any of my previous work, have no fear. This is a new series, and no knowledge of either the Rhaera Chronicles or the Rhaera Revelations is necessary to fully enjoy this tale. Also, reading this book won't expose you to spoilers, so there's no concerns on that front. This series is meant to be a separate entryway into the world of Alan. And if you want to read more, well, there are 9 books, told in 6 volumes, waiting for you. For those who have read the Rhaera books, I should mention that this series is set 3,000 years before the events in those novels. You might think you know how the First Empire was formed, or at least some general ideas about the events. But having read my books, you probably realize that things aren't always as they seem. The events I've revealed through Rhaera haven't been entirely accurate. After all, history is written by the victors. In this series, I can set the record straight, and you'll know the truth in myths and the lies of legends. For those unfamiliar with my process, I'm unusual in that I write all the books in a series before publishing the first novel, and these books continue that tradition. Why is this important? Well, there are several reasons. First, it allows me to weave threads throughout the entire narrative. Minor references that seem initially unimportant will usually provide some interesting insights upon rereading. This is possible because I'm able to spread out details across the entire storyline as if it were one book. Second, writing this way assures me and my readers that the books are working toward an ultimate conclusion. Too often, series wander off track, and it's questionable if the author will be able to rein in everything when all is said and done. I'm honored by the praise the Rhaera Revelations conclusion has received. The series' satisfying ending was mostly due to my ability to make tweaks, add characters, or provide foundational support in earlier books when an interesting idea came to me as I wrote a later one. Plus, there is no fear about me being hit by a bus and leaving you wondering how the full story plays out. Third, writing all the books in advance allows me to tell the story unburdened by the constraints of publishing contracts or business concerns. In fact, when I started this series, I had intended a trilogy, but as the plot emerged, it grew into 4 and then 5 books. Had I signed a contract with just one book completed, I might have been forced to make some difficult decisions to fit the narrative into a box that was determined by the deal brokered. Without that restriction, I was able to tell the story in the way that makes the most sense for the narrative as a whole. Fourth, writing the entire series relieves me from deadline pressure. I'll admit that I hate trying to create on the clock. The muse doesn't always cooperate on demand, and I really enjoy being able to write the books without the company of a ticking bomb. Without constraints, I'll produce the best work possible because a book is finished when I say it is, rather than when the clock runs out. Last, but certainly not least, you're guaranteed to get the book in a timely manner. Too often readers are frustrated by constantly wondering when, or if, the next book of a series will appear. Having all the books written eliminates that concern. Sure, there could be publishing considerations regarding when to release a particular title. But my job has been completed, and I can move on to the next project. One final thing I should note. For any aspiring authors out there, this isn't how I recommend approaching your own writing. There are many good reasons why most series aren't produced this way. I'm an outlier by using this method, and while it produces the highest quality product for me, it could result in years and years of wasted effort when employed by others. Well, that's more than enough preamble. I just wanted to give a little peek behind the process to help set expectations. Now, turn the page, tap the screen, or adjust the volume. A new adventure awaits.
Chapter 1 Of Gods and Men. In the days of darkness before the war, men were called runes. We lived in Runeland, or Rulin, as it was once known. We had little to eat and much to fear. What we feared most were the gods across the Burn River, where we were not allowed. Most people believe our conflict with the Frey started at the Battle of Granford, but it actually began on a day in early spring when two men crossed the river. The Book of Brin. Wraith's first impulse was to pray. Curse, cry, scream, pray. People did such things in their last minutes of life. But praying struck Wraith as absurd, given that his problem was the angry god 20 feet away. Gods weren't known for their tolerance, and this one appeared on the verge of striking them dead. Neither Wraith nor his father had noticed the god approach. The waters of the nearby converging rivers made enough noise to mask an army's passage. Wraith would have preferred an army. Dressed in shimmering clothes, the god sat on a horse and was accompanied by two servants on foot. They were men, but dressed in the same remarkable clothing. All three silent, watching. "Hey," Wraith called to his father. Herkimer knelt beside a deer, opening its stomach with his knife. Earlier, Wraith had landed a spear in the stag's side, and he and his father had spent most of the morning chasing it. Herkimer had stripped off his wool limor, as well as his shirt, because opening a deer's belly was a bloody business.
"What?"
He looked up. Wraith jerked his head toward the god, and his father's sight tracked to the three figures. The old man's eyes widened, and the color left his face. "I knew this was a bad idea," Wraith thought. His father had seemed so confident, so sure that crossing the Forbidden River would solve their problems. But he'd mentioned his certainty enough times to make Wraith wonder. Now the old man looked as if he'd forgotten how to breathe. Herkimer wiped his knife on the deer's side before slipping it into his belt and getting up.
"Oh,"
Wraith's father began. Herkimer looked at the half-gutted deer, then back at the god.
"It's okay."
This was the total sum of his father's wisdom, his grand defense for the high crime of trespassing on divine land. Wraith wasn't sure if slaughtering one of the deity's deer was also an offense, but assumed it didn't help their situation. And although Herkimer said it was okay, his face told a different story. Wraith's stomach sank. He had no idea what he'd expected his father to say, but something more than that. Not surprisingly, the god wasn't appeased, and the three continued to stare in growing irritation. They were on a tiny point of open meadowland, where the Burn and North Branch rivers met. A pine forest, thick and rich, grew a short distance up the slope behind them. Down at the point where the rivers converged lay a stony beach. Beneath a snow-gray blanket of sky, the river's roar was the only sound. Just minutes earlier, Wraith had seen the tiny field as a paradise. That was then. Wraith took a slow breath and reminded himself that he didn't have experience with gods or their expressions. He'd never observed a god up close, never seen beech-leaf-shaped ears, eyes blue as the sky, or hair that spilled like molten gold. Such smooth skin and white teeth were beyond reason. This was a being born not of the earth, but of air and light. His robes billowed in the breeze, and shimmered in the sun, proclaiming an otherworldly glory. The harsh, judgmental glare was exactly the expression Wraith expected from an immortal being. The horse was an even bigger surprise. Wraith's father had told him about such animals, but until then Wraith hadn't believed. His old man had a habit of embellishing the truth, and for more than 20 years Wraith had heard the tales. After a few drinks, his father would tell everyone how he'd killed 5 men with a single swing, or fought the north winds to a standstill. The older Herkimer got, the larger the stories grew. But this four-hooved tall tale was looking back at Wraith with large, glossy eyes. And when the horse shook its head, he wondered if the mounts of gods understood speech.
"No, really, it's okay,"
Wraith's father told them again, maybe thinking they hadn't heard his previous genius.
"I'm allowed here."
He took a step forward and pointed to the medal hanging from a strip of hide amid the dirt and pine needles stuck to the sweat on his chest. Half-naked, sun-baked, and covered in blood up to his elbows, his father appeared the embodiment of a mad barbarian. Wraith wouldn't have believed him either.
"See this?"
his father went on. The burnished metal, clutched by thick, ruddy fingers, reflected the midday sun.
"I fought for your people against the Gularoons in the High Spear Valley. I did well. A Frey commander gave me this. Said I earned a reward."
"Durain clan," the taller servant told the god, his tone somewhere between disappointment and disgust. He wore a rich-looking silver torque around his neck. Both servants did. The jewelry must be a mark of their station. The gangly man lacked a beard, but sported a long nose, sharp cheeks, and small, clever eyes. He reminded Wraith of a weasel or a fox, and he wasn't fond of either. Wraith was also repulsed by how the man stood. Stooped, eyes low, hands clasped. Abused dogs exhibited more self-esteem. What kind of men travel with a god?
"That's right. I'm Herkimer, son of Heimdall, and this is my son Wraith."
"You've broken the law,"
the servant stated. The nasal tone even sounded the way a weasel might talk.
"No, no, it's not like that. Not at all."
The lines on his father's face deepened, and his lips stretched tighter. He stopped walking forward, but held the medal out like a talisman, his eyes hopeful.
"This proves what I'm saying, that I earned a reward. See, I sort of figured we,"
he gestured toward Wraith,
"my son and I, could live on this little point."
He waved at the meadow.
"We don't need much, hardly anything really. You see, on our side of the river, back in Durea, the dirt's no good. We can't grow anything. And there's nothing to hunt."
The pleading in his father's voice was something Wraith hadn't heard before and didn't like.
"You're not allowed here."
This time it was the other servant, the balding one. Like the tall, weasel-faced fellow, he lacked a proper beard, as if growing one were a thing that needed to be taught. The lack of hair exposed in fine detail a decidedly sour expression.
"But you don't understand. I fought for your people. I bled for your people. I lost 3 sons fighting for your kind, and I was promised a reward."
Herkimer held out the medal again, but the god didn't look at it. He stared past them, focusing on some distant, irrelevant point. Herkimer let go of the medal.
"If this spot is a problem, we'll move. My son actually liked another place west of here. We'd be farther away from you. Would that be better?"
Although the god still didn't look at them, he appeared even more annoyed. Finally, he spoke.
"You will obey."
an average voice.
Wraith was disappointed. He had expected thunder.
The god then addressed his servants in the divine language.
Wraith's father had taught him some of their tongue. He wasn't fluent, but he knew enough to understand the god didn't want them to have weapons on this side of the river. A moment later, the Tor servant relayed the message in runic.
Only Frey are permitted to possess weapons west of the burn. Cast yours into the river.
Herkimer glanced at the gear piled near a stump, and, in a resigned voice, told Wraith,
Get your spear, and do as they say.
And the sword off your back,
the Tor servant said. Herkimer looked shocked, and glanced over his shoulder, as if he'd forgotten the weapon was there. Then he faced the god and spoke directly to him in the Frey language.
This is my family blade. I cannot throw it away.
The god sneered, showing teeth. It's a sword,
the servant insisted. Herkimer hesitated only a moment.
Okay, fine. We'll go back across the river right now. Come on, Wraith.
The god made an unhappy sound. After you give up the sword,
the servant said.
Herkimer glared. This copper has been in my family for generations.
It's a weapon. Toss it down.
Herkimer looked at his son, a sidelong glance. Although he might not have been a good father, wasn't, as far as Wraith was concerned, Herkimer had instilled one thing in all his sons. Pride. Self-respect came from the ability to defend oneself. Such things gave a man dignity. In all of Dorea, in their entire clan, his father was the only man to wield a sword, a metal blade. Wrought from beaten copper, its marred, dull sheen was the color of a summer sunset, and legend held that the short-bladed heirloom had been mined and fashioned by a genuine Durg smith. In comparison with the god sword, whose hilt was intricately etched and encrusted with gems, the copper blade was pathetic. Still, Herkimer's weapon defined him. Enemy clans knew him as Copper Sword, a feared and respected title. His father could never give up that blade. The roar of the river was cut by the cry of a hawk soaring above. Birds were known to be the embodiment of omens, and Wraith didn't take the soaring wail as a positive sign. In its eerie echo, his father faced the god.
I can't give you this sword.
Wraith couldn't help but smile. Herkimer, son of Heimdall, of Clan Dorea, wouldn't bend so far, not even for a god. The smaller servant took the horse's lead as the god dismounted. Wraith watched. Impossible not to. The way the god moved was mesmerizing, so graceful, fluid, and poised. Despite the impressive movement, the god wasn't physically imposing. He wasn't tall, broad, or muscled. Wraith and his father had built strong shoulders and arms by wielding spear and shield throughout their lives. The god, on the other hand, appeared delicate, as if he had lived bedridden and spoon-fed. If the Frey were a man, Wraith wouldn't have been afraid. Given the disparity between them in weight and height, he'd avoid a fight, even if challenged. To engage in such an unfair match would be cruel, and he wasn't cruel. His brothers had received Wraith's share of that particular trait.
You don't understand.
Herkimer tried once more to explain.
This sword has been handed down from father to son.
The god rushed forward and punched Wraith's father in the stomach, doubling him over. Then the Frey stole the copper sword, a dull scrape sounding as the weapon came free of its sheath. While Herkimer was catching his breath, the god examined the weapon with revulsion.
Shaking his head, the guard turned his back on Herkimer to show the tall servant the pitiable blade. Instead of joining the god's ridicule of the weapon, the servant cringed. Wraith saw the future through the weasel man's expression, for he was the first to notice Herkimer's reaction. Wraith's father drew the skinning knife from his belt and lunged. This time the god didn't disappoint. With astounding speed, he whirled and drove the copper blade into Wraith's father's chest. Herkimer's forward momentum did the work of running the sword deep. The fight ended the moment it began. His father gasped and fell, the sword still in his chest. Wraith didn't think. If he had paused, even for an instant, he might have reconsidered, but there was more of his father in him than he wanted to believe. The sword being the only weapon within reach, he pulled the copper from his father's body. With all his might, Wraith swung at the god's neck. He fully expected the blade to cut clean through, but the copper sliced only air, as the divine being dodged. The god drew his own weapon as Wraith swung again. The two swords met. A dull ping sounded, and the weight in Wraith's hands vanished, along with most of the blade. When he finished his swing, only the hilt of his family's heritage remained. The rest flew through the air and landed in a tuft of young pines. The god stared at him with a disgusted smirk, then spoke in the divine language.
"Not worth dying for, was it?"
Then the god raised his blade once more as Wraith shuffled backward.
"Too slow, too slow." His retreat was futile. Wraith was dead. Years of combat training told him so. In that instant, before understanding became reality, he had the chance to regret his entire life.
"I've done nothing," he thought, as his muscles tightened for the expected burst of pain.
It never came. Wraith had lost track of the servants. So had the god. Neither of the combatants expected nor saw the tall, weasel-faced man slam his master in the back of the head with a river rock the size and shape of a round loaf of bread. Wraith realized what had happened only after the god collapsed, revealing the servant and his stone.
"Run," the rock-bearer said. "With any luck, his head will hurt too much for him to chase us when he wakes."
"What have you done?"
the other servant shouted, his eyes wide as he backed up, pulling the god's horse away.
"Calm down,"
the one holding the rock told the other servant. Wraith looked at his father, lying on his back. Herkimer's eyes were still open, as if watching clouds. Wraith had cursed his father many times over the years. The man neglected his family, pitted his sons against each other, and had been away when Wraith's mother and sister died. In some ways, many ways, Wraith hated his father. But at that moment, what he saw was a man who had taught his sons to fight and not give in. Herkimer had done the best with what he had, and what he had was a life trapped on barren soil because the gods made capricious demands. Wraith's father never stole, cheated, or held his tongue when something needed to be said. He was a hard man, a cold man, but one who had the courage to stand up for himself and what was right. What Wraith saw on the ground at his feet was the last of his dead family. He felt the broken sword in his hands.
"No!"
the servant holding the horse cried out as Wraith drove the remainder of the jagged copper blade through the god's throat. Both servants had fled, the smaller one on the horse and the other chasing on foot. Now the one who had wielded the rock returned. Covered in sweat and shaking his head, he trotted back to the meadow. "Merrill's gone," he said. "He isn't the best rider, but he doesn't have to be.
The horse knows its way back to Alan Rist.
He stopped after noticing Wraith.
What are you doing?
Wraith was standing over the body of the god. He'd picked up the Frey's sword and was pressing the tip against the god's throat.
Waiting. How long does it usually take?
How long does what take?
For him to get up.
He's dead. Dead people don't generally get up,
the servant said.
Reluctant to take his eyes off the god, Wraith ventured only the briefest glance at the servant, who was bent and struggling to catch his breath.
What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
I want to know how long we have before he rises. If I cut off his head, will he stay down longer?
The servant rolled his eyes.
He's not getting up. You killed him.
My tetlin ass! That's a god! Gods don't die, they're immortal!
Really, not so much,
the servant said, and to Wraith's shock he kicked the god's body, which barely moved. He kicked it again, and the head rocked to one side, sand sticking to its cheek.
See? Dead. Get it? Not immortal. Not a god, just a Frey. They die. There's a difference between long-lived and immortal. Immortal means you can't die, even if you want to. Fact is, the Frey are a lot more similar to runes than we'd like to think.
We're nothing alike. Look at him.
Wraith pointed at the fallen Frey.
Oh, yes, the servant replied. He's so different. He has only one head, walks on 2 feet, and has 2 hands and 10 fingers. You're right. Nothing like us at all.
The servant looked down at the body and sighed. His name was Shigon, an incredibly talented harp player, a cheat at cards, and a Bredith Ein Mir, which is to say...
The servant paused.
Nope, there is no other way to say it. He wasn't well-liked, and now he's dead.
Wraith looked over suspiciously.
Is he lying? Trying to put me off guard?
You're wrong, Wraith said with full conviction. Have you ever seen a dead Frey? I haven't. My father hasn't. No one I've ever known has. And they don't age. They do, just very slowly.
Wraith shook his head.
No, they don't. My father mentioned a time when he was a boy, and he met a Frey named Neeson. 45 years later they met again, but Neeson looked exactly the same.
Of course he did. I just told you, they age slowly.
Frey can live for thousands of years.
A bumblebee lives for only a few months. To a bumblebee, you appear immortal.
Wraith wasn't fully convinced, but it would explain the blood. He hadn't expected any. In retrospect, he shouldn't have attacked the Frey at all. His father had taught him not to start a fight he couldn't win, and fighting an immortal god fell squarely into that category. But then again, it was his father who had started the whole thing.
Sure is a lot of blood.
An ugly pool had formed underneath the god, staining the grass and his glistening robes. His neck still had the gash, a nasty, jagged tear like a second mouth. Wraith had expected the wounds to miraculously heal, or simply vanish. When the god rose, Wraith would have the advantage. He was strong, and could best most men in Dorea, which meant he could best most men. Even his father thought twice about making his son too angry. Wraith stared down at the Frey, whose eyes were open and rolled up. The gash in his throat was wider now. A god, a real god, would never permit kicks from a servant.
Okay, maybe they aren't immortal.
He relaxed and took a step back.
My name is Malcolm, the servant said. Yours is Wraith.
Uh-huh, Wraith said.
With one last glare at the Frey's corpse, Wraith tucked the jeweled weapon into his belt and then lifted his father's body.
Now what are you doing?
Malcolm asked.
Can't bury him down here. These rivers are bound to flood this plain.
Bury him? When word gets back to Alan Rist, the Frey will...
He looked sick.
We need to leave.
So, go.
Wraith carried his father to a small hill in the meadow and gently lowered him to the ground. As a final resting place, it wasn't much, but would have to do. Turning around, he found the god's ex-servants staring in disbelief.
What?
Malcolm started to laugh, then stopped, confused.
You don't understand.
Glynn is a fast horse and has the stamina of a wolf. Merrill will reach Allenrist by nightfall. He'll tell the Instaria everything to save himself. They'll come after us. We need to get moving.
Go ahead,
Wraith said, taking Herkimer's medal and putting it on. Then he closed his father's eyes. He couldn't remember having touched the old man's face before.
You need to go too!
After I bury my father.
The rune is dead!
Wraith cringed at the word.
He was a man.
Rune, man, same thing.
Not to me, and not to him.
Wraith strode down to the riverbank, littered with thousands of rocks of various sizes. The problem wasn't finding proper stones, but deciding which ones to choose. Malcolm planted his hands on his hips, glaring with an expression somewhere between astonishment and anger.
It'll take hours! You're wasting time!
Wraith crouched and picked up a rock.
The top had been baked warm by the sun. The bottom was damp, cool, and covered in wet sand.
He deserves a proper burial, and would have done the same for me.
Wraith found it ironic, given that his father had rarely shown any kindness. But it was true. Herkimer would have faced death to see his son properly buried.
Besides, do you have any idea what can happen to the spirit of an unburied body?
The man stared back, bewildered.
They return as manes to haunt you for not showing the proper respect, and manes can be vicious.
Wraith hoisted another large, sand-colored rock and walked up the slope.
My father could be a real cull when he was alive. I don't need him stalking me for the rest of my life.
But
what?
Wraith set the rocks down near his father's shoulders. He drew the outline before starting the pile.
He's not your father. I don't expect you to stay.
That's not the point.
What is the point?
The servant hesitated, and Wraith took the opportunity to return to the bank and search for more rocks.
I need your help,
the man finally said. Wraith picked up a large stone and carried it up the bank, clutched against his stomach.
With what?
You know how to... well, you know, live. Out here, I mean.
The servant looked at the deer carcass, which had gathered a host of flies.
You can hunt, cook, and find shelter, right? You know what berries to eat, which animals you can pet, and which to run away from.
You don't pet any animals.
See? Good example of how little I know about this sort of thing. Alone, I'd be dead in a day or two. Frozen stiff, buried in a landslide, or gored by some antlered beast.
Wraith set the stone and returned down the slope, clapping his hands together to clean off the sand.
Makes sense. Of course it makes sense. I'm a sensible fellow, and if you were sensible, we'd go. Now.
Wraith lifted another rock.
If you're bent on sticking with me, and in such a hurry, you might consider helping.
The man looked at the riverbank's rounded stones and sighed.
Do we have to use such big ones?
Big ones for the bottom, smaller ones on top.
Sounds like you've done this before.
People die often where I come from, and we have a lot of rocks.
Wraith wiped his brow with his forearm, pushing back a mat of dark hair. He'd rolled the woolen sleeves of his undertunic up. The spring days were still chilly, but the work made him sweat. He considered taking off his Lee Moore and leather, but decided against it. Burying his father should be
an unpleasant task, and a good son should feel something at such a time. If uncomfortable was the best he could manage, Wraith would settle for that. Malcolm carried over a pair of rocks and set them down, letting Wraith place them. He paused to rub his hands clean.
"Okay, Malcolm," Wraith said. "You need to pick bigger ones, or we'll be here forever."
Malcolm scowled but returned to the bank, gathered two good-sized stones, and carried them under his arms like melons. He walked unsteadily in sandals. Thin, with a simple strap, they were ill-suited to the landscape. Wraith's clothes were shoddy, sewn scraps of wool with leather accents that he'd cured himself, but at least they were durable. Wraith searched for and found a small, smooth stone.
"I thought you wanted bigger rocks," Malcolm asked.
"This isn't for the pile." Wraith opened his father's right hand and exchanged the rock for the skinning knife.
"He'll need it to get Sorel, or Elysian, if he's worthy. Nifril, if he's not."
"Oh, right." After outlining the body, Wraith piled the stones from the feet upward. Then he retrieved his father's lemur, which still lay next to the deer's carcass, and laid it over Herkimer's face. A quick search in the little patch of pines produced the other end of the copper sword. Wraith considered leaving the weapon, but worried about grave robbers. His father had died for the shattered blade. It deserved to be cared for. Wraith glanced at the fray once more.
"You're certain he won't get up?"
Malcolm looked over from where he was lifting a rock.
"Positive. Shigon is dead."
Together they hoisted a dozen more rocks onto the growing pile before Wraith asked,
"Why were you with him?"
Malcolm pointed to the torque around his neck, as if it explained everything. Wraith was puzzled until he noticed the necklace was a complete circle. The ring of metal wasn't a torque, not jewelry at all. It was a collar.
"Not a servant, a slave."
The sun was low in the sky when they dropped the last rocks to complete the mound. Malcolm washed in the river while Wraith sang his mourning song. Then he slung his father's broken blade over his shoulder, adjusted the fray's sword in his belt, and gathered his things and those of his father. They didn't have much. A wooden shield, a bag containing a good hammerstone, a rabbit pelt Wraith planned to make into a pouch as soon as it cured, the last of the cheese, the single blanket they had shared, a stone hand axe, his father's knife, and Wraith's spear.
"Where to?"
Malcolm asked. His face and hair were covered in sweat, and the man had nothing, not even a sharpened stick to defend himself.
"Here, sling this blanket over your shoulder. Tie it tight and take my spear." "I don't know how to use the spear."
"It's not complicated, just point and stick." Wraith looked around. Going home didn't make sense. That was back east, closer to Alan Rist. Besides, his family was gone. The clan would still welcome him, but it was impossible to build a life in Dorea. Another option would be to push farther west, into the untamed wilderness of Averlyn. To do so, they'd need to get past a series of Frey outposts along the western rivers. Like Alan Rist, the strongholds were built to keep men out. Herkimer had warned Wraith about the fortifications of Meridid and Sion Hall, but his father never explained exactly where those were. By himself, Wraith could likely avoid walking into one. But he wouldn't have much of a life alone in the wilderness. Taking Malcolm wouldn't help. By the look and sound of the ex-slave, he wouldn't survive a year in the wild.
"We'll cross back into Rulin, but go south."
He pointed over the river at the dramatic rising hillside, covered with evergreens.
"That's the Crescent Forest. Runs for miles in all directions. Not the safest place, but it'll provide cover. Help hide us.
He glanced up at the sky. Still early in the season, but there should be some food to forage and game to hunt.
What do you mean by not the safest place?
Well, I've not been there myself, but I've heard things.
What sorts of things?
Wraith tightened his belt and the strap holding the copper to his back before offering a shrug.
You know, tabers, row, leshies, stuff like that.
Malcolm continued to stare.
Vicious animals?
Oh, yeah, those two, I suppose.
Those two?
Sure, bound to be in a forest that size.
Oh,
Malcolm said, looking apprehensive as his eyes followed a branch floating past them at a quick pace.
How will we get across?
You can swim, right?
Malcolm looked stunned.
That's 1,000 feet from bank to bank. It has a nice current, too. Depending on how well you swim, we'll probably reach the far side several miles south of here. But that's good. It'll make us harder to track.
Impossible, I'd imagine,
Malcolm said, grimacing, his sight chained to the river.
The ex-slave of the Frey looked terrified, and Wraith understood why.
He'd felt the same way when Herkimer had forced him across.
Ready? Wraith asked. Malcolm pursed his lips. The skin of his hands was white as he clutched the spear.
You realize this water is cold? Comes down as snowmelt from Mount Mador.
Not only that, Wraith added, but since we're going to be hunted, we won't be able to make a fire when we get out.
The slender man with the pointed nose and narrow eyes forced a tight smile.
Lovely. Thanks for the reminder.
You up for this? Wraith asked, as he led the way into the icy water.
I'll admit it's not my typical day.
The sound of his words rose in octaves as he waded into the river.
What was your typical day like?
Wraith gritted his teeth as the water reached knee-depth. The current churned around his legs and pushed, forcing him to dig his feet into the riverbed.
Mostly, I poured wine.
Wraith chuckled.
Yeah, this will be different.
A moment later, the river pulled both of them off their feet.
Chapter 2 The Mystic. Dol Ren was a grassy hill, nestled alongside the Crescent Forest, where a log lodge and several hundred mud and thatch roundhouses were protected by a wood and earthwork wall. Looking back, I realize it was a crude, tiny place where chickens and pigs roamed free, but it was also where the chieftain of Clan Wren lived and ruled. And it was my home. The Book of Brin. Persephone knew everyone on the Dol, making strangers stand out, and the girl at the gate was stranger than most. Small, young and slender, the visitor was boyish with short, unevenly hacked hair. Persephone couldn't tell if the sun had darkened her face or if it was merely dirty, but it was decorated with elaborate tattoos, delicate curling thorns that swirled along cheeks, bracketing her eyes and mouth. The designs lent her a mysterious quality. Framing her face, they provided an expression both permanently quizzical and intensely serious. She wore a dirty cape of ruddy wool, a leather and fur vest, a skirt of cured hide, and an odd belt. Persephone wasn't certain, but she thought the belt was made of animals' teeth. Curled up at the girl's side lay a white wolf. Its keen blue eyes darted, watching the movements of everyone who walked toward them. Few did. The newcomer stood outside the Dol's gate next to Cobb, who'd come down from his perch on the wall and held his spear as menacingly as he could, which was to say, not at all.
The man's usual job was feeding the pigs and keeping them out of the communal garden, a task previously held by 8-year-old Thea Wedden, and one at which Cobb often failed. Most men took turns keeping watch on the wall above the gate. That morning it was Cobb, and, as with the pigs, he was having trouble.
"We have a visitor, ma'am,"
Cobb told her, pointing at the girl with his spear. He nodded toward the ram's horn, tethered around his neck, and grinned as if blowing it had been an achievement worthy of praise. Persephone had to admit he'd done a better job watching the gate than the pigs.
"She says she's a mystic and wants to speak to the chieftain."
The girl couldn't be much more than 12, and although she did look like she'd spent most of her life in the wilderness, she was too young to be a mystic. "I'm Persephone, Lady of the Lodge." She waited for any sign of understanding. When none came, she added, "I'm Chieftain Reglan's wife. My husband is away on a hunt, but you can talk to me." The girl nodded, but said nothing more. She stood there, biting her lower lip and shifting her sight with every dropped hoe, shout, or hammerfall. On closer inspection, Persephone decided the girl was more malnourished than thin, and Filthy didn't begin to describe her. Pine needles and leaves littered her hair, and dirt caked her legs. She had bruises on her arms, scrapes on her knees, and it was dirt rather than the sun's tan on her face.
"May I help you?" "What's he hunting?"
the girl asked.
"Excuse me?" "The chieftain."
Persephone hesitated. She'd been doing well that day by not letting herself think too much, banishing the horrible event to a dark corner that she'd revisit only once her husband returned. But the question had shone a bright light, and Persephone struggled to maintain her composure.
"None of your business!"
Cobb came alive, taking a genuinely menacing step forward. The threat wasn't in the spear, which at that moment hung slack and forgotten at his side, but rather in his voice, which was heartfelt and angry.
"A bear," Persephone said.
She took a breath and straightened her back.
"A terrible bear called the Brown." The girl nodded with a frown.
"You know it?" Persephone asked.
"Oh, yes. Grin the Brown is famous in the forest, ma'am, and not well liked."
"Grin the Brown?"
"That's what we call her, on account of how she sneers at everyone and everything. I've even seen her sneer at the sun. And who doesn't like the sun?"
"That bear killed my son," Persephone said, the words coming out more easily than she'd expected. This was the first time she'd said them, and somehow she thought they would refuse to pass her lips.
"Killed Mina's family, too," the girl said, looking at the wolf. "Found her in the crescent, just like Tura found me. I took Mina in. Clearly we're sisters, and you can't turn away family. Tura thought so, too."
"You know Tura?"
"She raised me."
All at once the tooth belt, the facial markings, and even the weathered ash staff made sense. Persephone remembered Tura's bony hands holding just such a staff.
"So Tura sent you to us?"
The girl shook her head.
"Tura is dead. I set fire to her myself."
"You did what?"
"Was her wish, ma'am. Didn't like the idea of worms. I think she wanted to fly. Who wouldn't?"
Persephone stared at the girl for a moment, then said,
"I see,"
even though she didn't. Persephone had no clue what any of that meant, then realized it didn't matter.
"What's your name?" "Suri," the girl said.
"Okay, Suri." Persephone looked at the wolf.
I'd like to invite you in, but we have chickens and pigs inside the doll, so Mina, is it, can't come in.
Mina won't hurt them,
Suri said, sounding insulted and a dash angry. Tattoo tendrils around her eyes curled tight. Wolves eat chickens and pigs. The girl smirked and folded her arms roughly over her chest.
They eat people, too. But you don't see her gnawing on your leg, do you?
Persephone looked at the wolf, which lay curled up, innocent as a shepherd's dog.
Does seem pretty tame.
What do you think, Cobb? The ineffective pig wrangler turned mediocre gate guard shrugged.
All right, but keep an eye on her. If she attacks anything, there's a good chance someone will put a spear through her.
Persephone led the way inside the gate.
As she did, Suri whispered, Not a very welcoming place, is it, Mina? Wonder how they'd like it if we put a spear in their sides when they come to the forest and hunt our animals.
Spring was dragging her feet, leaving a colourless world of matted grass, leafless trees and grey skies. But the people of Dol Ren weren't waiting. Everyone was more than tired of the long winter, and with the first mild day of the year, the inhabitants of the Dol were out working. The Killian boys, wellsprings of pent-up energy, even in midsummer, were up on the sagging cone-shaped roof of their family's home. They were tying in new sheaves of thatch to replace the ones winter had ripped away. Bergen, the brewer, was splitting wood and feeding the fire under boiling vats of sap he'd gathered. Others were prepping the communal garden, which, at that time of year, was nothing more than a miserable patch of bare mud, where last autumn's stubble remained like sun-bleached bones. Cobb returned to his perch on the wall, and Persephone led Suri up the gravel path to the large lodge in the centre of the doll. The almost forgotten song of birds was back, and Persephone spotted yellow and blue wildflowers on the sunny side of the well. Winter was over, according to the stars, birds and flowers, but snow remained in the shady places. Persephone pulled her mourning shawl tight. Spring was being selective that year. It hadn't come for everyone. Persephone paused in the open common before the lodge's steps and bowed to the stone statue of the goddess Mera. Suri watched with curious interest, then followed. The big doors to the lodge stood open, casting sunshine into the hall of Reglan, which had been a smoky wooden cave since autumn. Illuminated by firelight in the dark of winter, the 12 pillars holding up the roof always appeared golden, but in harsh sunlight they were revealed as old and weathered. The bright light exposed more reality than just the pillars. Discarded shoes, a cloak hanging from the antlers of a deer's head, and a ram's horn goblet in the corner where Oswald had thrown it at Sackett months before. The raised wooden floor surrounding the smouldering fire pit was coated with dirt and ash. Sunlight had a way of showing the realities that shadows born of firelight hid. The eternal fire burned low in the central pit, and Habit, whose job was to keep it stoked, was missing. Persephone added a split of wood, and the room brightened a little. Crossing to the pair of chairs near the far wall, the only chairs in the room, Persephone sat in the one on the right. Suri had stopped at the door. She peered at the rafters of the peaked roof, where shields of past chieftains hung, along with trophy heads of stags, wolves, and bears. She grimaced, then looked across the room toward Persephone, eyeing the floor as if it were a deep lake, and she unable to swim. Then, with effort, the girl and the wolf entered. "How old are you, Suri?" Persephone asked as the girl made her way across the hall.
"Don't know. Maybe 14?"
The girl spoke absently, her attention still on the rafters.
Maybe. That's my best guess. Might be more, might be less.
You don't know.
Depends on how long I spent with the Crimbles. Tora was fairly certain I'm a Malkin.
A what? A Malkin?
Suri nodded.
When a Crimble steals, you know what a Crimble is, Mum.
Persephone shook her head. Suri sucked in a breath, glancing at the wolf beside her as if the two shared a secret, then explained.
Well, a Crimble is a creature of the forest. They don't actually live there, just come and go, you see? They're common in the Crescent, lots of doorways because of all the trees. They dwell in Nog, a place deep underground, where they have grand halls and banquets. They dance and make merry in ways you can only imagine. Anyway, when a Crimble steals a baby, they steal babies?
Oh, grandmother of all, yes. All the time. No one knows why. Just a thing with them, I suppose.
Anyway, when they steal one, they take it back to Nog, where who knows what happens. On rare occasions, one sneaks out. They're called Malkins, and aren't quite right again because anyone spending time in Nog is forever changed. Now, usually, a Malkin is older, like 10 or 12. But somehow, I managed to get out before my first year. That's when Tora found me.
How did you get out before you could walk?
Suri, who by then had completed the bulk of her journey, looked at Persephone as if she'd said the craziest thing.
How should I know, Mom? I was just a baby.
Persephone arched her brows and nodded.
I see, she said.
But what she actually saw was how even an innocuous question such as, how old are you, wasn't a simple matter for a girl with a belt of teeth and a pet wolf. Best to keep matters simple.
All right, Suri. What is it you need?
Need, Mum? The girl asked. Why are you here?
Oh, I came to tell the chieftain we're going to die.
The girl said it quickly and with the same casual indifference as if she were announcing that the sun sets in the evening. Persephone narrowed her eyes.
Excuse me? What did you say? Who's going to die?
All of us.
All of whom?
Us. The girl looked puzzled, but this time Persephone wasn't certain if it was the tattoos or not.
You and I?
Suri sighed.
Yes, you, me, the funny man with the horn at the gate, everyone.
Everyone in Dal Ren? The girl sighed again.
Not just Dal Ren, everywhere.
Persephone laughed.
Are you saying all living things are going to die? Because that's not exactly news.
Suri looked to Mina, a pleading in her eyes as if the wolf might help explain.
Not all living things, just people. People like you and me.
You mean runes? All the runes are going to die.
Suri shrugged.
I suppose. I think perhaps you should back up. Start with when and how this will happen.
Don't know how.
Soon, though.
Should start before high summer, I suspect. Definitely before winter.
She paused,
thought, and then nodded. Yes, definitely before the snows come. And by this time next year, we'll be in the worst of it. That will be the edge of the knife. The peak of the storm.
So, it's a storm that's coming? The girl blinked, furrowed her brow, scowled and shook her head.
Not an actual storm, just a bad thing. Although...
She shrugged.
It could be a storm, I suppose.
And you have no idea what is going to cause this... Or why such a terrible thing will happen?
No, not at all.
the mystic said, as if such things held no importance.
Persephone leaned back in her chair and studied the girl. She was a sad case, an